The human brain is a complex organism, so complex that we are nowhere close to understanding it. Back in the 1970s, one scientist, an American physician and neuroscientist named Paul MacLean, put forth a theory to describe the evolution of the brains of human beings and other vertebrate mammals. MacLean proposed that the brain consists of three independent consciousnesses that were added one at a time over the course of evolution. He identified these three parts of the brain as the reptilian brain, the limbic system, and the neocortex. Now, it is important to point out that MacLean's theory is no longer held by the majority of neuroscientists. For one thing, we know that the brain works in unison, all of its parts working together, not as three independent consciousnesses. However, MacLean's ideas have been adopted by some psychiatrists to help explain human behavior. So, with that in mind, let's take a look at this triune brain theory. According to MacLean, the most recent addition to our brains is the part he calls the neocortex. And this part governs our language, our abstract thinking, our reasoning, and our ability to plan. It's really what makes us have a human culture. Now, the second oldest part of the brain is the limbic system, and this is the center of our motivation, our emotions, our memories, including our behaviors like parenting. The limbic system is a little below our rational thinking. It's more of who we are. But the part that interests me for today is the part that MacLean says is the oldest part of our brain, which he calls the reptile brain or the reptilian brain. Some call it our lizard brain. And it is here that we find the primitive desires related to hunger and thirst and reproduction and territoriality. It also governs our habits and our procedural memory. You know, like putting your keys in the same place every day without even thinking about it. The reptile brain is our base code. It can be rigid and compulsive. Say, imagine someone cuts you off in traffic and you react angrily. Or there's one last cookie on the table and you grab it. Or a balloon pops and you jump. These are the responses of our reptilian. These actions protect us and they helped us survive the dangers of nature and wild animals and our enemies. The reptilian brain doesn't waste time in thoughts or thinking. It just reacts. It hijacks our thinking brain and throws us into that fight or flight reflex. Now, as I said, MacLean's theory has largely been dismissed, but the ideas have been used as a model to explain human. I mean, come on, who among us hasn't felt that overwhelming drive of the reptile brain when we've been wronged or frightened? Here in the 10th chapter of the Gospel according to Mark, Jesus and his disciples are traveling towards Jerusalem for the Passover festival. This, as we know, will be Jesus' last time to visit the city. For the past 3 years, Jesus has been preaching throughout the region of Galilee, and in this time, he's developed a substantial following. He's built up a reputation among the people. And along this journey to Jerusalem, Jesus tells his disciples what's going to happen to him when they reach the capital. He tells them, "We are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be handed over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death. Then they will hand him over to the Gentiles. They will mock him and spit upon him and flog him and kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise again." As Christians, we identify these warnings of Jesus as the passion predictions. Jesus tells them once. He tells them twice. And then in our reading, he tells them a third time. After Jesus tells the disciples of his fate, two of them, the brothers, James and John, they approach Jesus, a request. They say to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." Did you hear that? They don't couch this demand as a favor. They don't soften their request by saying something like, "Jesus, we know you've got a lot going on right now, but we were wondering if it's not too inconvenient, and we hope we're not out of line on this," but no. They just say straight up, "We want you to do whatever we ask." And so Jesus says to them, "What is it that you want?" And the brothers answer him, "Grant us to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left, in your..." And Jesus says to them, "You have no idea what you are. Can you drink the cup that I drink? Are you able to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized?" Now, Jesus' words we recognize as being sacramental language, talking about the cup of communion and the baptism. But what Jesus is really saying underneath all this is simple. He says, "Do you think you can walk in my shoes and go where I go?" And they answer, "Yeah, we can do that." And Jesus tells them, "It will be as they demand, but as we know, it won't be they expect." Traditionally, we come down pretty hard on the two sons of Zebedee. We label them as clueless for not understanding Jesus' warnings of his fate of Jerusalem. We ridicule their arrogance at bossing Jesus around like they do. We say that they are just looking for fame and celebrity because they believe that when Jesus hits the bright lights of downtown Jerusalem, things are going to happen. And they want to be part of it. I mean, up in Galilee, he's been a hit. The crowds there adore him. But just think what it's going to be like in the capital city. As I said, traditionally we do come down hard on James and John. But I think I know what they're doing here. I think that they do understand that the end is near, that Jesus is going to be taken from them. And they sense that their time is short. And they ask for those seats riding shotgun with Jesus, not because they're clueless, but because they're scared. They made their demand because they want to be first in line. And they're afraid there's not going to be enough for everyone. Enough of what, though? Well, I guess enough of Jesus. Enough of Jesus' radiance, his being, his glory. I believe that they were afraid that Jesus' glory is going to run out before it gets to them. And so this becomes a time of crisis. It's their fight or flight moment. Their reptile brains take over. They want to grab what they can before it runs out. The other disciples catch wind of this discussion between Jesus and the Zebedees, and they, as we know, were less than pleased. The brothers, they had jumped the line, and what should have been an even 12-way split was now unbalanced. They responded in fury. There is something in our reptile brain that keeps us in constant fear of not having enough. Enough? Enough what? Well, whatever it is that we feel we need to survive. It is our instinct of self-preservation. It may be food or shelter, companionship, love, N95 mask, water chestnuts. We constantly fear to run out and that we will die. And our fear is based on the anxiety of scarcity. I mean, we can be surrounded by excess and still be worried that there won't be enough. Scarcity controls our lives more than we are willing to admit. Some years back, in an article in the Christian Century magazine, the Old Testament scholar Walter Brueggemann wrote about scarcity. And in that article, he said, "We never feel that we have enough. We have to have more and more, and this insatiable desire destroys us. Whether we are liberal or conservative Christians, We must confess that the central problem of our lives is that we are torn apart by the conflict between our attraction to the good news of God's abundance and the power in our belief in scarcity, a belief that makes us greedy and mean, unneighborly. In our nation today, as more and more power drifts to the extremes, those in the middle feel the imagined squeeze of scarcity, that there's not enough for all, that there's not enough for me, or worse, that if I do have something, somebody's going to take it from me. And so we want to reach out and grab what we can while we can. And meanwhile, we know that the other person out there is doing the same thing, and this fuels our anxiety. So what is it that we're afraid of today? A scarcity of jobs, of food, of water? Are we afraid that someone's going to take away what I've worked so hard to acquire, that we're going to lose relevance, influence, power, prestige, or our lives? For the reptile brain in self-preservation mode, where it always is, these are its primary concerns. The reptilian response is to keep what you have, preserve and protect it from others, and get more and more at the expense of others. To get more than you need, to get more than you will ever need. And that's still not enough, is it? We can continue reading that article by Walter Brueggemann where he says, "The myth of scarcity that can drive an economy is not based on an economic analysis, but indeed on it produces and justifies violence against nature. The myth of scarcity makes each an agent of acquisitiveness in the face of all the others who pursue acquisitiveness." But can't we be more than that? Can't we be more than just the sum of all our fears? Can't we be more than our reptile brains? And the answer, of course, is yes. We can. Through Jesus, through Christ, in God, we are more than that. The antidote to anxiety and scarcity is abundance. And our holy scriptures open with the greatest act of abundance of all time, the act of creation itself. The first chapter of Genesis is just a litany of abundance in which God creates and creates and creates, and it was good. Where is it in Scripture that God ever says, "I'm sorry, there's not enough for you"? Even the Hebrews wandering through the wilderness had enough. For 40 years, God rained manna down on them. It was an abundance and never a scarcity. And we all know the wonderful story of Jesus feeding thousands with what appeared to be just a scarcity. It was, in fact, an abundance. The brothers James and John viewed Jesus' glory as being limited, and so they coveted it for themselves. But there was no need, because Jesus' glory is indeed infinite. But it's our reptile brain, our sin, to question the abundance of God's. Just yesterday, you, as a congregation, denied scarcity a seat at the table as you proclaim the abundance of God's love. As a congregation, we stared scarcity in the face, and we created food to go to those who are the true victims of scarcity. You donated and you worked to create those 10,000 meals for people that we will never meet. Yesterday, you embodied the words of the Apostle Paul, words that he wrote in his letter to the church in Corinth, saying, "And God is able to provide you with every blessing in abundance, so that by always having enough of everything, you may share abundantly in every good." We have abundance. And so we shared. We shared our money. We shared. So that others, God's blessing to us in Jesus is not about power or glory. It's not about food or wealth. It is quite simply about love. Love shared in abundance. God is love. And that love, like God, is infinite. And we should never fear that this love will run out or that will ever be held back from us. That love exists more than we can ever imagine, and certainly more than we can ever need. And so it should be our mission as a congregation of church, as the people of God, as disciples of Jesus Christ, to show the gracious abundance that we find in God, to say to the world, you do not need to. God is with you. Lastly, I would like to close these words from Psalm 72. May there be abundance of grain in the land. May it wave on the tops of the mountain. May its fruit be like Lebanon. And may people blossom in the cities, the grass of the field. Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who alone does wondrous things. Amen.